Hello, everybody. This is Maya, back with the Chris Front Podcast. New season, episode number 2. Very, very excited to have Jeanette Wall with me today, label manager in the US for City Slang and also an all-around very accomplished industry person. So many things at once. Jeanette, please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me, Maya. Yes, US label manager extraordinaire for the Berlin eclectic punk angel baby label, Slang. One of the most just special group of freaks I could ever be a part of. But yes, also a soon-to-be podcast host. In addition to being, perhaps because of my experience in the music industry, I am an avid horror movie aficionado. But also I've just always loved horror movies. But yeah, I've watched so many at this point, and it's kind of all I talk about. And I basically had a bunch of friends that were like, you should just like start talking about this. So I wanted to think of a special angle. And so I thought, you know, as I sort of seep out of quarantine in my personal life and like try to, get back out there in the dating world, I'm like, I feel like a monster, an alien, a witch. And so I wanted to talk about sex, love, and romance and what you can learn from horror movies about those things. So, Horrors of Love, coming soon to a podcast listening device near you.
That's incredible. I love that so much, and I cannot wait to give it a listen, to be honest. Anyways, today though we're here to talk about the music industry a little bit more. And so in case you're listening to this podcast for the first time, what I'm trying to do with this is basically try to make an entrance into the industry a bit more accessible for younger people trying to sort of break in. I myself, you know, have come a long way to get to where I even am, and it's not easy, particularly being a marginalized person. Hence doing this podcast and talking to guests about how they go into the music industry and what kind of advice for newcomers they have, and just how to work things out. And that's what we're here for, really. Yeah. So Jeanette, let's start with you. How did you get started? I know you have quite a long CV and quite a lot of things happening, and quite a sort of diverse roster of jobs that you've done. So I'm intrigued to hear.
I have a lot of hats in my closet. And a lot of skeletons too. No. Wrong podcast. Yeah, I grew up in a suburban town in Indiana, and I didn't have my understanding of what the music industry was pretty much just came from like Almost Famous and High Fidelity. So I had a pretty a naive view of what it was, but I knew I really loved music and from a young age, and I even played in a couple of bands. Hold on, I'm gonna. I played in a couple of bands in high school, and one of the guys that I was in a band with ended up making solo music. I think we were around 14 or 15 at the time. This was the age of MySpace, if you can believe it, not to age myself. But I had this friend who was writing these songs and wanted to put them on MySpace, but his parents were very wary of the internet, and having a social media profile on the internet was such a like foreign thing. Like it was like something very, you know, stranger danger was still alive and swinging. And so basically, and I was a total latchkey kid. So I offered to help him run his MySpace for him. And I think, you know, I was 14, 15. And I ended up doing this and selling CDs over the mail with my like home address on the MySpace page. It was so shoddy. Like, it was
That's
not
so cute. Cool. I love it though.
Well, it was, I was apparently, I just found this talent for telling people about music. I just messaged every person that I could find on MySpace who liked other artists that were similar to his music. And I just was like the crazy spam DM, but I would spend hours crafting these messages, like hand to hand combat.
Wow.
And I eventually got him to be the number one unsigned artist on MySpace. And I ended up like, you know, cause I had my email on there and all my contact info on there because Chase was, oh God. And I'm not going to say his full name cause you cannot listen to this music. It's rough. It's not, it's like the height of like acoustic singer songwriter, like white boy, it's not cute, but but at any rate, I ended up on my coffeegal12@yahoo.com email address emailing with like the heads of A&R for Atlantic and Columbia and like all these crazy, and I was like 16 like at the time, like I really had zero context. I knew what label Death Cab for Cutie was on, and I didn't really even understand the difference between independent and major labels. Like, I just really had zero context for it. And he ended up signing with Universal Republic and, like, had this sort of, you know, prototypical American major label career, mm-hmm. where, you know, he got dropped after a couple label or after a couple records. And,
yeah.
Like, but at any rate, I ended up getting sort of headhunted by the program that I went to for college because all these lawyers and A&R people were like, there's this child in the middle of fucking nowhere, Indiana, who like is doing shit. And so, and this was also the time where a bunch of music industry programs were in vogue. I don't know mm-hmm. what that was, like the Clive Davises. I went to Syracuse. And so I kind of just got like, and I was, at the time I was like in true Almost Famous fan fashion. I was like, I'm going to be Cameron Crowe. I'm going to be Chuck Klosterman. I'm going to be Rob Sheffield. I want to be a music writer. And so I guess it was a way for me to get like a full ride to college and learn more about the music industry. And I was mm-hmm. like, well, I can already write, I guess, because I'm, you know, an 18-year-old. So I, yeah. And so then I ended up going to this program, and I was totally like, you know, I felt definitely I wasn't a Nepo baby like a lot of the others. I went to college with Drew from the Chainsmokers, like fucking what? and you know, and I just went to college with a lot of people who had, they didn't, you know, we didn't learn how to advance shows. We didn't learn how to pay out bands after the gigs. We didn't learn how to like upload music to TuneCore. So I ended up just doing all this shit myself. I found a really cool group of older students who were putting on house shows, and I got in with them. I worked at the radio station, and I started my own tape label called Miscreant Records, and I had a zine that I put out twice a week. We put out 60 issues, I think.
Still running, technically, the Miscreant label, right?
It's in retirement. It's like soft retirement, but maybe she'll come back. You never know. But we did. We put out early records for Vagabond, Adult Mom, Jawbreaker Reunion, as we were just shouting out Lily.
Yes.
And I just found myself really drawn to a lot of like these amazing, and this was like, to be transparent, this was like totally before I really came to terms with my queer identity. Mm-hmm. I really, you know, I had a long way to go being from bumfuck America. And so I really took the opportunity to surround myself with people, for better or worse, who were excited about what I was doing. And yeah, I made a lot of mistakes, but I think, you know, I fostered some good karma, because now I'm in kind of an unbelievable dream job situation where I get to have a lot of autonomy at the label I work at, and also sign amazing artists who I feel like are supported around the world, and they're prioritized around the world in a way that I haven't experienced at other labels. I feel like, especially with American labels, it's been so like American focused. So, and also everyone's like a kind of gay and weird, and it's just, and everyone's punks. Everyone's like a socialist.
Yeah.
It feels good. I definitely, if you can work for a European employer, deep rec. But yeah, okay. So I kind of went through my whole life story, and maybe that wasn't what you asked, but you got it.
I feel like I want to get to the listener a little bit more as well is sort of what different jobs did you go through to kind of get to where you are? Like, you know, like think back to you sort of to the moment where you were like, hey, I want to do music, I will work in music, and sort of what, but at the same time, probably just you, like to you, just like, you know, everybody else, it probably felt like a really like huge task, and like, how do I get in? I don't know people. How do I, but I don't, I need people to break in, but if I don't know people, and like, how did you break out the rut? And like,
how do you get experience for the jobs that require 3 years experience?
Exactly, like, pretty much that,
that's like all
conundrum
of them.
Yeah. Yeah, like sort of, and like just looking through kind of the stuff that you did, I saw you basically did some writing and kind of got in through a bit of
a press
angle.
I forgot I was a blogger.
Look, it's a thing that a lot of people are doing, and incredibly like a backbone of the industry that people are doing.
Absolutely.
That, you know. So I was just wondering, kind of, how did you navigate that? You know.
Oh, of course. So I think a part of like starting the zine was like I said, I really loved writing as a kid, and I kind of saw myself as, you know, going in to be a music writer. And simultaneously, I'm starting the zine. I'm finding, you know, I'm having my friends interview their friends and writing about their favorite bands. It was really like, I didn't really edit anything. I just like, it was completely submission based, but it was like really easy way to find other people who like want to write about music, who are playing music, yeah, who want their bands promoted. And I think especially I realize things are quite a bit different now, but I think the kind of basic premise still goes, if you build it, they will come. And it's, you know, I think that in retrospect, I just really was hungry to find my community. And that hunger led me to push open any door where I could feel like there were other people on the other side who got it. And I think also, I think the new generation coming up is a lot more discerning, a lot more savvy, a lot less trustful, perhaps, but not in a bad way, just sort of a lot more discerning. And I was so overly eager and naive. And I was also, you know, come from a place where I was, you know, I just didn't know a lot of times. Mm-hmm. So I worked with a lot of people. I think that that's, you know, one thing that I'm thankful for in a lot of ways, because it gave me the chance to make a lot of big mistakes and learn a lot of hard lessons really early in my life. And now I'm totally perfect at 31 years old. I know everything, and I will never make another mistake again. And that's really cool for me. So I'm happy to shed my wisdom. But yeah, so I, you know, and at the time too, you know, I was like, I want to work at Spin Magazine. I want to go to, you know, I had this like fantasy of what it looked like. Cause I like thought that, you know, Ben Fong Torres was still like writing at Rolling Stone. Like I was just like, I just was so hungry to learn more and so earnest. So, but one thing I quickly learned, everyone was like, all the internships at magazines suck. All you do is go get coffee for people and you don't actually do anything. So I was like, what's the next closest thing? PR. So I ended up working at, at the radio station, you know, because part of my program too, we had to do internships. So I did a lot of unpaid internships, mm-hmm. which I think rightfully so are not as in vogue as they were. Maybe they are in some corners of the industry, but like, I, you know, I'm don't condone that free labor vibe that is such a backbone of this music industry, and especially in America, it's so dark. But and anyway,
yeah, at the time, we don't like that here.
No, I mean, at the time though, I was like so naive, it was so normalized to me, and I just didn't, I hadn't been radicalized yet, help her. And so I tried to find these places. Like, I ended up in doing this zine and this the blog for the radio station, I ended up interviewing Sharon Van Etten for, and it was like right before she opened Pitchfork Fest. This was like right after the first, I think, single came out of the first record. Like, this was very early. And she messaged me on Facebook and was like, the painting the time, this was the time where you message people on Facebook, and was like, do you want to interview me? If you're coming to Pitchfork Fest, I saw you live in Indiana. If you're coming up here, you should interview me for your blog. And I was like, yeah, for sure. Like, I should. I think I should, because I was already obsessed with her.
Yeah.
And we just got to be kind of friendly, and she ended up introducing me to Ben, who currently still runs Bada Bing Records, and they offered me an internship for the summer, because like, I was clearly, honestly, showing up and being eager, it wins you a lot of friends.
Honestly, so. Yeah, I feel like that's such a huge lesson that I feel like I have to keep learning over and over again. Like, you know that thing, like, particularly sort of self-employment, you have a really good job, and as it is in self-employment, you always get 100% of the jobs, and you have to like turn down half of them, and then you get 0% of the jobs when you need them. Do you know what I mean? Like, and so every single time I'm in that zero phase, I always struggle to believe that the next 100 phase is coming, but it always does. And so it's really just about reminding myself that the best way to make that next 100 phase come is to put myself out there. Because how would somebody hire me if I don't tell them that I'm available and that they know that I exist?
Well, we're all in our own little worlds. But I also think that's such a crucial lesson for life. It's like, you know,
gotta put yourself out there.
And also, this too shall pass. You know, everything. It's so, I think I've spent the last 10 years knowing that I don't have control over the waves of the ocean and my life.
Just gotta let them come. Yeah. Yeah, truly.
So that's my sage advice.
Hey, look.
The good shit will come. It always does. It's you know, and I realize I say this from a place of privilege, but also.
Yeah, fair though.
It does get better. Like, it does.
Like, I was saying that actually to Avanti in the podcast that I did with her. I feel like I wish I had listened to this podcast when, like, 5 years ago or something. When
you're
I was trying
the
to
Lord's
sort of,
work.
You know, I mean, I'm not saying that there's not other great podcasts out there. I'll give a little shout out to Adam L. Mikayas, who does this incredible podcast, Don't Shit on the Bus. Really, really good. Nice.
I'm listening to that immediately. That's such a good podcast name.
Do you know him? He's this photographer that kind of came up through like the Warped Tour scene and whatever. And like he kind of quickly grew to be like the most well-known alternative music photographer type of person, right? And everybody knows him for like his bald head and always like running around on stage. And like he grew up with like touring with the Data Remember and like whatever, all these bands. And so like think of that scene, what you will. I do think that he put quite a lot of work in and sort of, you know, working his way out of that a little bit. And
it was also it was like the time we were coming.
I grew up
like,
in that as well. So, yeah. But either way, he does this incredible podcast now. But nonetheless, it's still most of these podcasts in the end are men running it.
Totally.
And it's rarely, and like men tending to interview their men friends as it goes, you know. And when you made a career out of the Warped Tour, then chances are you don't come across that many women. Hey,
Well, not many, and probably not many women who want to talk about their experience.
That too. Yeah, yeah. And so I feel like, you know, maybe this podcast can sort of be part of the next wave, if that makes sense. We should call it like the post-warp till generation of diversity and jokes aside though, like I think it's important to have these conversations and, you know, and quite frankly, like I'm fully aware of still kind of having a bit of a unicorn status being a very openly out and about trans person in this industry. And I, like, just from talking to so many of the artists that I tour manage and manage full time as an artist manager, whatever, all these things I do, I definitely have, you know, noticed, like, some have straight up told me just how glad they were to finally have somebody sort of apply to them or whatever, that is not just some dude, you know. And I think it massively changes everything, you know, to challenge the energy of status quo.
It changes the energy of everything.
Yeah.
And it's also like, because there's such a, I don't want to be all on my yes all men little crone corner over here, but I do think that, you know, through, because you, and also there's like something to be said for cis women, like watching the evolution of how cis women have functioned in the music industry as the oppressed and the oppressor, as they are in so many
as they are
in general. Let's bring in the third wave feminism. Let's bring da, 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 da. But I think it's also, it's interesting because it's like, you know, I felt indoctrinated, like me being a naive person, and I think, you know, really up until you know, and obviously I'm not saying like all my experiences in the music industry for the last 10 years have been bad. Like a lot of them, I mean, changed my life for the better and I learned so much. And even the bad ones I had amazing moments with. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that I noticed is, yes, I was often the only woman in the room. I was definitely the only queer person in the room. And I think there were so many microaggressions that I internalized through most of my 20s that I'm now unlearning. And I think that it's almost like you have to learn how important it is for your voice to be heard as you're learning how to talk. And I think that for me, I was constantly in white male only spaces, as so many people are. but somehow they're everywhere. But I think I really allowed myself to feel small in a lot of those spaces. And I think that is why I, you know, and that sort of comes from me opening every door, right? And being very undiscerning and the people that I worked with early on. And I think that though, you know, it's amazing when I look back though at all the times where I've had people be like, thank you for like speaking up, and I'm like, this just seems like what you do. And I'm kind of, in some ways, I'm glad that I was in those spaces because it forced me to figure it out and figure out how to like, and I wasn't always very graceful. Sometimes I got very angry. I had a lot of anger in my 20s. But I was if somebody was fucking with my artist, I was like, I was so like a mom. Like I was like so protective.
I feel that, you know, being out on the road, tour managing, there's definitely some situations that happen, you know? And so, yeah, I feel that being incredibly defensive, like, you know, the classic, you know, which person's skin color will be singled out in the border control. It's, you know, it's always the same thing. And the times I've had to, the times, you know, it was so clear who was getting pulled out, and, you know, like somehow then having to, I don't know, talk that officer down from their power trip and just be like, you know, why did you single out that person or whatever. And
I think it's also, the amazing thing about that, I'm having this thought as you're saying this, like, I learned how to do that for other people before I learned how to do that for myself. Mm-hmm. And I think that is some, I mean, that's just how life is sometimes. You just, this is how, this is kind of what growing up is, what growing a prefrontal cortex is. So I think that the more you can learn how to do that for yourself first, and I think that younger people are definitely learning that because they have to. Because
I agree.
Look at the,
look
at the world they're inheriting. Look at the music industry they're inheriting. Oh my God. Like, it's a fucking mess. Like, touring, everything is so, like, because it's so much of the music industry is built on this exploitation of labor, exploitation of people of color, exploitation of queer people, exploitation of women, the like layer cake of bullshit. It's crumbling under the weight of COVID, under the weight of changing minds about how the world should work.
Honestly, though, like, do you also feel like the last couple of years, for all the crap that's sort of been brought to the surface and, like, you know, amplified through the state of the world, I feel like I am the most excited to be in the industry as it is right now in, like,
oh my
ever.
God, yes.
Like, the windows of opportunity that are opening at the moment, like, you know, shouting out, you know, I feel like Meet Me at the Altar, honestly, were kind of the ones that sort of started that a little bit. And it was incredible to sort of see them make that jump. And, you know, it was pretty obvious that Pink Shift were going to be the next ones, which they are. You know, and it's just, I'm just kind of waiting to see who's the next one, basically, to sort of jump through that window and finally bring, I mean, surely Bartizes is maybe a slightly different scene, but I feel like proper, we're starting that work, like, way earlier already. I mean, they've been around. Fun fact, I got to work with them on their first ever European tour. When they were
Meet
still
Me
called
at the
Great
Altar?
White, no, proper.
When
they were still
so
called
sweet.
Great White, way back in the day, and I got to work with them again this year for their European tour that they did earlier, and I got to book the European mainland portion, so that was fun. It's just incredible to see different stories finally getting to the forefront. And I'm all here for it. And you know, Mia and Pom Pom Squad coming forward and having such absolutely massively well-deserved success right now, like, I genuinely feel like things are changing.
It does feel like, I feel like this is the maybe the pattern, right, is that the people that you see in front of the mic shift, but the people in the, you know,
yeah,
I do think that, so here, I'll talk some shit. I do think that the thing I've noticed in the last, probably definitely the last like 5-6 years, is that there's this trend of kind of using specifically, and it's less so now, but it's specifically cis white women or cis white female musicians as kind of props to make the music industry look more woke and safe than it is, and not to, and to their, you know, not to their knowledge, but also to their benefit, because I think there's a lot of white men who use artists that have sort of woke cachet.
Big topic.
I mean, to weasel their way into places that they don't know how to act. And it's not that they're not welcome. It's just they don't know how to treat other people with respect. So I think that this is an important shift, because I think those people, who you're talking about, all these artists, they demand respect from the people around them. And I think it changes all of the artists you're talking about. I think of the people who I know who work on their teams, and they're all sort of a part of the, even if they are white men, they are part of changing this shit. And they're part of changing the standards with which we treat people in the music industry. Like, at this, I think the most wonderful thing about where I'm at right now is that, you know, I have a lot, due to some of my more sordid experiences, which we don't need to talk about on this podcast, but I definitely have had a lot of people who trigger the fuck out of me, and like, and also I know who for me personally aren't safe, and it's like, you know, I don't need to say that they're good or bad people, but just for the, my context, they're not like, there's like 80% of the dudes who run managers in the US, I'm like, I can't even talk
to. I was kind of waiting for you to bring up that conversation, because I know that you've worked as a manager as well. Did you work with Mitski back in the day?
Yes, I did. I was, because, you know, for her, you know, we met when we were in college, and yeah, I mean, I really, that was the one of the first projects that I really saw that I was good at what I did. Mm-hmm. And I think
clearly you were, like, you know, I mean,
thank you.
Obviously, you know, she and her music have transcended in so many ways, but as somebody that works as an artist manager as well, you know, I see work when I see it, do you know what I mean? Like, and I know how much goes into it behind the scenes. And yeah, maybe some of the industry is not ready for that conversation, but, you know, particularly the arts management space, which is basically the most powerful space you can have in the industry, pretty much. They are the ones that hire everybody else.
90% men.
That's kind of the problem. And like,
gatekeepers.
I'll freely tell you that, you know, that I've definitely had my moments where I was kind of wishing to, you know, not be working with a man every single time, and that I definitely feel it's harder to like, you know, what CV are they gonna take, do you know what I mean, when you apply yet again to another
tour?
And also,
why are they gonna take it?
Like, yeah, it's like
on either side there's a lot of I feel like there's a lot of hiring the right people for the wrong reasons, and that creates power imbalances that are kind of very gray in this. Mm-hmm. And not to say that they shouldn't hire queer, trans, any, like,
oh, I've definitely been hired
people.
For being a queer tour manager, fuck it,
which
I'll
is,
take the money.
I mean, which is great, but it's also like, I think when people don't have intention behind, the intention behind it is self-serving. Mm-hmm. It doesn't inform, and this is, of course, this is me on my like little high horse as someone who has learned the hard way that, you know, especially specifically white, queer, it's conventionally attractive people are not necessarily going to be the voice of that movement and don't necessarily need to be. I guess I just mean to say that I feel like a lot of male managers that I've worked with who even have brought me on are like, they think they're doing me a favor, you know? And it's, ooh, like, that shit is like
spicy.
I mean, but no, but it's like if you're trying to create this power dynamic where you think that, you know, because I'm a woman or because I'm queer, you can give me an opportunity that I wouldn't have had otherwise, that puts you in your mind at least in a position of power in the way that you talk and the way your body language is. Think that
like every single time there's a dual manager situation and the main manager is always a dude who then brings
and he talks the most
who then like brings on this like random not men person, mm-hmm, as the co-manager, I always think about that. And then like, and
Mark
then like
is the other way.
And like, who's in CC and who's the main email person? I always think, I've actually done that thing where I consciously switch that order. Like,
that's genius.
Look, I do that all the time when I deal with like that kind of situation. I always put the men in CC.
You have to put them in their place.
Look, it's just like, you know, I don't like, it's not me trying to be petty, but I genuinely think that it's those little things that you know,
you're just equaling the scales. Yeah. As a Libra, yeah. I appreciate this.
Good.
We're in Libra season. It's all about equaling the scales. You gotta make sure everybody's, because that's how you keep shit above board, right? Keeping things on an even playing field allows everyone to see everything that's going on. I love a unilateral hierarchy. That's like, I mean, and that's one of the amazing things about the label I'm at now is like, granted, you know, there are people who have been there 25 years who, I mean, of course, I'm learning from. They're my mentors. They're my heroes. They're my, like, you know, they're who I'm looking. But for the most part, I find this with a lot more European-based companies, but also I realize this is not a blanket statement. But there is it's a lot less about, like, the ego of the power dynamic in these music industry, whatever, insert management companies, labels, whatever. It's more about having, you know, and the other thing with, and I think it comes from the fact this, you're not getting your entire sense of self-worth from your job.
Yeah.
And so that's
a very European versus American capitalism perspective, and I appreciate it.
Well, yes. And it's also because it's like, if you aren't seeking validation from that, then you are less likely to subscribe to this individualist mindset that forces you to act like a fucking asshole, because that's what creates power in these situations. So I think, you know, I haven't read Marx, but he seems cool.
speaking about city slang, by the way.
Yes.
So, as somebody who's European based, yet at the same time, sort of mostly existing as a work persona in the US, which is a very weird dynamic.
It is. But you learn a lot about cultural languages.
Sure, I do. And like, as somebody who's sort of constantly between continents, sometimes quite physically in that way, you know, city slang being a European based label, but with, you know, you being the US label manager and kind of always having had and continuing to have the goal of bringing sort of American indie rock to European shores, I kind of how's that going, I reckon, and like how do you feel about kind of the European music industry essentially being completely oversaturated by just American artists coming over all the time, yet at the same time struggling to bring European talent in the US, which first and foremost is a thing about, you know, the visa situation in the US, but
it's a nightmare,
but also how completely impossible it seems for European artists and like crew people, etc., to find their way into the US. Like, why is it so permeable to the one side but not the other?
I think it's, well, I think it's America's and it's a younger country. We still think we're the best and the biggest, and we're still convinced that we need to tell everyone that. Being a 250-year-old country really leads to a lot of issues. Because you haven't learned, I mean, I don't know, whatever, I don't need to go on this tangent, but listen to, I don't know, different, listen to Behind the Bastards or something.
I feel like the two of us could have like five different podcasts with such like different topics, you know? We should definitely co-host something. That'd be so fun.
I need to read a little bit more, but I do, I'm an armchair historian, I tell you what.
Hell yeah.
But I think, you know, it's funny because, so City Slang was founded by a tour manager, the city, Christoph Ellinghaus, our fearless leader. He tour managed Nirvana. He tour managed, he was, you know, he tells this amazing story about the first time Courtney Love came over to Europe, and he was driving her, I believe, from Hamburg to Berlin, and she popped a cassette in. And it was Nevermind. And she said, this record is going to change the world. And he was like one of the first people to hear it.
Wow.
So he's an OG. And so he got started because he was a man, you know, he managed, tour managed. He booked shows in Berlin. He booked amazing festivals outside of Berlin. He was very, he just had, he and his, I think he had a very close friend when he was young, that they just got really into all of the indie rock that was happening in the 80s and 90s. And he was like, people need to, it's happening over there. It'll happen over here. So yeah, I think that's such an amazing, I've never phrased it like this, but you really encapsulated how like City Slang really was all about bringing US talent over. So like anything that got signed to Sub Pop or Merge, oftentimes City Slang would release that in Europe or ex-US.
Yeah.
So that was the model for probably about 20 years. I think, like, you know, there's, and Christoph also signed really, for the time, like, and for now, unheard of, but like,
yeah,
these exceptionally artist-friendly deals where you sign for 10 years, 15 years license. That's why we don't have the whole catalog anymore, but that's also, you know, whatever. It's, he has the test pressings with Courtney's notes on the side, which I think is just as valuable in a lot of ways, but he has the shit that's going in museums. So I think, you know, at, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it became very apparent that this is, we're in a global, you know, the internet made it a global society. So I think he very rightfully had an amazing manager that he worked with, who was working at Secretly at the time and lived in Indiana and was working with one of our artists in Kane. He had this Kevin, who was my predecessor, kind of build out the infrastructure for the company over here and like helped set up all these business things that I thank God they were done, because I could have never done it. I don't have the attention span. But it became apparent that it really, they really needed someone in New York, and they needed someone who had relationships with artists. And I just spent the 5 years before working at ATO signing artists. I signed Margaret Glasby, Natalie Press. I worked with signing Nick Hakim, Emily King, all these amazing artists that I think are kind of the reason that label is relevant. I'll say it. And so I mean, addition, obviously, Alabama Shakes Supremacy, whatever. But at any rate, I was in this place where I was like, I kind of hit my ceiling, and I really needed a lot more autonomy. I needed a lot more trust. And through my dear friend Josh Roth, he connected me to Christoph and was like, I think this girl is kind of, and I had also done PR for a long time, like I mentioned. So I had connections in lots of different parts of the industry, and I had been a manager, and I had my zine, and I worked in DIY shows. I bartended at Silent Barn, like all that shit. And so I just had my fingers in a lot of different pies, and I think I had my fingers in all the pies City Slang needed to be eating. So
honestly, yeah, sounds like a lot like it. Yeah.
And so I think that I definitely came in with my my internal infrastructure was so American and so like hungry and aggressive, and because that's like the only way I knew how to do things was by pushing, and it had gotten me in such a I'd gotten in such a corner from that, you know. I think like it because it's not sustainable, at least for me it was just like not sustainable to like have this like aggressive punching forward attitude about working in music, because it just wasn't conducive to making art happen. And yeah, I slowly had to undo that within myself, because it does not work with European mindset. It is just intrinsically
story of my life. Yeah,
because it's
culture differences are massive.
And the language, like working with people whose English isn't their second language makes your, I had such thin skin too, because I was just, you know, constantly absorbing microaggressions for 10 years. So I just was like, or more probably, I don't know. But I just, it took me such a long time, especially with Germans. Oh my God. You learn how to not be very sensitive around Germans real fast, because it's not personal.
You bet.
And I think, and it's also like, when people move with you with love and with consideration and with and respecting boundaries and asking about your boundaries, I mean just like the by the nature of like the German holiday calendar, it's like I think one of the things I asked Christoph, I tell this story a lot, I'm sorry, I'm bouncing around, but I asked him before he hired me, I was like, how many sick days do we get? And he was like, what do you mean? Like, if you're sick, you stay home. I don't know. And it was such a foreign concept. And like, All the music industry people, because I like, you know, I had some friends look over my contract for me. They were like, you should make sure to get sick days in your contract. And he was just like, what are you talking about? Like, no, like, that's not how we do things.
Yeah.
And I quickly, and I'm, of course, everyone jokes like Jeanette doesn't actually take her for vacation days. And I'm slowly forcing myself. I'm still having to like really force myself to. And even when I do take vacation days, I have to like, really, this sounds like such minutia, but it is like kind of the backbone. I mean, 80% of this industry happens on a fucking email.
Look, so, very like, same, yes. But you've got to shut those emails off. But yeah, I do want to follow that thought of like, I feel like what I particularly want to bring out sort of in this podcast is, I guess, the importance of cross-Atlantic relationships and why
we need more of that.
Why bringing those cultural differences together can be so good and meaningful. And like, I'm thinking about myself starting to manage artists exclusively in the US because that's just kind of where my career is, even though I'm technically not based there. I think something that I've noticed really quickly is that sort of that European approach to a lot of like work ethic in a way and sort of that approach to like even things like sick days and but like generally having a different cultural perspective brought in form of like your manager or whatever who's still is super well connected in the US as well. Like, just having somebody that all I'm saying is getting more cultural perspectives onto a domestic situation can be very, very fruitful. And I think that's incredible. And Europe has played a major role in so many American artists' careers. And I feel like it's definitely massively undervalued in so many ways.
The rest of the world too. Latin America, Japan, Australia.
Yeah, like 100%.
I think that the thing about what you're speaking to is also the European music industry, in my experience, moves a lot slower.
Everybody's just out for camping for a month in summer and all the Americans are losing their mind about it.
Americans are like, I'm getting a tooth removed from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. If you need me, you can text me.
That tweet that goes around annually? Yes. Oh, yeah, very. I love
exactly that. And I mean, but I think there's a push and a pull, right? Because I still have like a lot of these systems where I'm like, let's go. And I don't think that they're all misused. I think that there is like a way to have that, to transpose that anxiety-driven enthusiasm into like actually productive thinking. So if I if I find myself getting overwhelmed with those feelings, with that like that ghost of Christmas past that's like, why haven't you done this? Especially in pandemic, dear God. Like, if there's some one thing that it's going to teach Americans to slow down a little bit, maybe it's a global pandemic. But I think, you know, that having started City Slang right before pandemic, and it really was a crash course in learning how to go slow, because if you go slow, gain more perspectives, and actually fucking think about what you're doing, you're going to make a lot more smart decisions, I think.
Sure.
And I think that's like, and granted, you might lose some opportunity, which is, you know, if you don't act now. But I do think that this is like where the American and European ideologies are at odds a lot of times, because feels like a lot of times you're walking against the wind. And instead, it's like, what if you just tried laying down? I don't know. But, like, you know what I mean?
I'm totally following you. And like, and I really, really appreciate, you know, you and City Slang kind of being open to that cross-Atlantic perspective. Because I don't feel like I'm seeing that very often in the industry. I mean, I understand it. If you're in the US, it is clearly by far the most powerful music industry in the world. There's, you know, no going around that, and you know, nothing will sort of surpass that, and that's fine. But I do think that it just can be really, really beneficial for sort of both ends to just have kind of more cultural exchange and also, yeah, just very physical exchange. You know, I've sort of built my entire career on bringing American artists over to Europe and UK and sort of having that infrastructure ready for them. You know, like I quickly realized that, you know, I quickly realized what needs sort of an American artist has when they're coming over on the plane. And so I just kind of decided to give all of that sort of to them. And so, you know, these days I have, you know, an entire backline and an instrument, etc., that's just sitting in the UK and like near London airports. And so, you know, I can just always sort of, you know, be like, hey, let me tour manage you. And also like the gears is in the price type thing, you know, like, and just kind of having that infrastructure ready to go and having all of these contacts around Europe, UK, and, you know, having played in bands myself a lot and like having toured fucking every venue in Europe and UK myself so many times, and just having all these relationships, I feel like is so, so valuable, such a valuable thing to offer to an American artist coming over, aside from just a very tour management, merch management, whatever job. And I feel like with Barty Strange, for example, this summer, it was really, really nice because he was incredibly open to me introducing him to people, which I incredibly appreciated. And so, for example, I got to introduce him to a publicist friend of mine in Europe, and turns out that, you know, turned out to be a really, really good conversation, and I hope that they get to work together in the future. Shout out to your Fleet Union in Germany. And and sort of going around, I got to introduce Bartiz to a lot of friends. You know, he agreed to have one of my friends, my favorite photographer, Martin, aka Ginger Dope, having to shoot him at the Phoebe Bridges London show. And just kind of one thing come to the other, and I feel like that cross-border communication is just so valuable for everybody, you know.
And it's also like why we do this shit. It's like we just want to hang out with our cool friends and like bring and have, because that, right, like that's, and that's the whole point of music. If you like want to go bigger brain with it, right, it's your I heard this, oh my gosh, when I was trying to sign Kaina, I was working on it. I had my friend Nicole drive me up to the middle of Vermont for this music festival, Otis Mountain Get Down, great fest. And I was, because I was like, I gotta see Kaina as many times as possible because she is so magical. And I just, and I had met them for the first time in New York, and I just fell in love because the whole group is just made of total angels, like such sweethearts. And so we went up and we watched Kaya's amazing set, and we're watching this other musician who I need to look up the name of. We can tag him in afterwards. But this artist, she was global, because also the thing with Otis is that it's a very global festival in the middle of the woods. And there is this artist, I believe she was Latin American, and she was saying like, the whole point of music is to provide a mirror of that explains my experience that reflects back at you, and you can reflect on your own experience.
Yeah.
And so if that ideology is injected into everything that you're doing in music, because that's like the point of music, that's why music was, you know, prehistorically, that's why music was a thing, was to convey messages to ancestors, to other people, whatever. Yeah. So it's like, if you keep the core of that at like the base of what you're doing, it's such a better way to be. And I think also to your point, like having those relationships globally, connecting people globally, that's like the point of music. That's like, point. It's so, and it's so amazing to like, and I think you find the, I think if that becomes the standard with which we move through this industry and how we treat people, it becomes a lot less aggressive, it becomes a lot less harmful, I think, in the long run. And I think the thing you were saying earlier that like, something clicked for me, I was thinking about, you said, like, America being the biggest music industry.
Yeah.
And the music, and so when America knows that, it prioritizes America over everything else. I mean, then this is, can you can, let's, separate podcast about, like, why the CIA is bad, insert here. why colonialism is bad, et cetera, et cetera. But I think if you, if America doesn't see value in other territories, then of course, then it's going to depreciate the value of those artists in their own territories, which I think is why, like, you know, Asia, especially Asian countries and, I mean, a lot of European and Canada. Oh, my God, Canada.
Oh, big very, conversation. Big conversation.
They're very protective of highlighting Native artists above American artists.
And that's so important. And that's something that's,
It's just like, and as we become a more global economy, that needs to shift because it's ultimately, you know, I'm obsessed. Like, you know, the band Foals? Do you know this band?
So. No.
They're from the like 90s or 2000s or something. Their career, and again, this is third hand information. So if this is wrong, somebody slap my wrist. But my understanding is that pretty much most of their career revolves around touring Mexico and Latin America. And that's just, and they're the, I think they're, Irish, I think. I don't remember.
Honestly, like, the South American countries are so overlooked. It's wild.
And they're honestly the fastest growing music markets
in the world. They are. And there are some, like, even, like, on a, like, just an ad space perspective. I remember having a conversation about that with somebody, like, it's some of the cheapest ad space, but some of the best revenue you can get, even on that very level, you know? And I often see that in bringing particularly the precious American artists out of America, audiences around the world are really like so excited to see them come over, like these, you know, big hype artists.
They're hungry for that energy.
Yeah.
Come to Brazil.
And like, fair enough. And for example, I was so glad to see Paramore announced just yesterday that they're going to South America for like a lot of shows in a lot of countries. I'm so glad that Lollapalooza is doing such a huge thing of you know, bringing artists from around the world into South America. Even though it's rough with, you know, all these flight aids and stuff, is a tough schedule, and especially in pandemic time, it's a difficult one and very expensive, etc. But I also remember, like, I think I was hearing, I was listening to, I think, a podcast with Data Rimba's guitarist, and he was also saying, like, they lost money on doing Lollapalooza run in South America, but it was so worth it because of that incredible growing fan base. And
Huge investment.
And I feel like more artists and more management teams and labels kind of need to see that, and I'm only slowly starting to see a sort of label operations that kind of do cross-border things between South America and North America and Central America more, but you know, it's happening, but it's slow. It's a slow process.
Listen, anytime I can get budget to hire Latin American PR, I do it, because it's huge. The streaming is growing so exponentially. And I think it's also just important for an artist's career to diversify your portfolio, diversify where you can go in the world. I think about, like, you know, I mean, there's so many artists that, like, you know, and maybe they're like Danish artists that are just huge in Denmark. And that's like what
that's
they do.
That's fair enough.
But
yeah,
that's also a career. You don't need to be.
Exactly. But in the end, the most successful artists tend to be the ones that are internationally successful, you know. And I love a band like Kvelertak in the metal space, but I was TMing one women this summer, and we got to do a festival in Norway, like hometown show with them, and they headlined, and we were basically co-headlining the festival. And it was incredible, you know. It was so good to see them, like, in like their home territory, but at the same time they're massively successful in the US and the UK, kind of all around the place, and in a way maybe that's the one advantage a lot of European artists have, like they from even just being in Europe, which in itself is such a more internationalist, globalist perspective, from just being a bunch of different tiny countries that, you know, work together.
Totally.
I feel like that is the one advantage European artists have once they break past the visa barriers to the US and other markets. Right. But once they're sort of past that, I feel like that's an incredible position to be in, because once you're big enough to have grown past those initial barriers, funny enough, American audiences and like critical press people, you know, critics, both is true. but like once you're past that barrier, all of a sudden the American music scene becomes incredibly interested in you, and just, you know, being like, oh, you have such an interesting story and such an interesting background, tell me more. And, you know, but jokes aside, I feel like that's a good way to wrap up a little bit, and like that's a great message, I feel like, to wrap up on, just like more globalism, more internationalism, and, you know, growing in different territories and thinking international helps all of us.
I totally agree. I think to that end, like, beyond just like a global perspective, diversifying the ways in which you determine your own success in the music industry, right?
Yeah.
Because if you just sort of chase after these sort of the same Spotify playlists, Pitchfork reviews, music festivals that everybody else is going after around you, there's only so many spots that you can have. And if that's the only way that you determine your own success as an artist, or even as someone behind the scenes, as a manager sending artists out into the world, like if that's how you determine their success, that if they don't get Pitchfork Best New Music, they're not successful, you're cutting yourself off at the knees, you know? I think that's it's so small. I guess I don't need to be making that kind of judgment call, but it's so short-sighted to not value the success of other the success that you can find in other countries and other communities and other, and I think that's such, it becomes really toxic if you don't learn to have to celebrate the wins that you get, and being able to kind of compromise and be like, you know what? I'm that artist that's going to be huge in Holland. And that's like how I'm going to make my career. And that is just as valuable, if not, it's just as valuable as the people who are like, I'm going to tour America. Cause like America's not more, it's more important in this because it says it is. And the more that we can kind of unindoctrinate that, the more we learn how to live more sustainably, the more we learn how to be more patient and kind to each other. And that's a better music industry. That's a more equal opportunity music industry. That's a more diverse music industry, dear God. So
honestly, what a perfect way to kind of, just really kind of summarize this amazing conversation. And I feel like, aww,
thank you, lovey.
I feel like I'm really excited to share this with, you know, my audience, which sort of is, I was just looking at podcast stats earlier, it's quite equal parts US, German speaking countries, and UK. So I feel like City Slang should fit right in with the listenership here as well. And but seriously, thank you for taking the time. You know, thank you for the incredible work you're doing and what you do.
Likewise,
for,
my dear.
For artists. And that's it for the Chris Front podcast today. Thank you for listening. And check back in for weekly episodes in this exciting season 3. Thanks very much. Bye.
Thank you for having me. Bye.